So, just tell me a little bit about the function last night. I know that you were made a literary lion. How did that go?
Well, it was very nice, actually. For me, it was like meeting a whole bunch of movie stars. I'd never seen Harold Pinter. I'd never seen Steven Spender. It was nice.
Antonia Fraser is better than Harold Pinter to see.
Indeed she is. Isaac Singer thought that my wife, Joan, was Antonia Fraser.
I noticed there were 26 literary lions. I know if they keep inducting that many every year, they're going to run out of writers, aren't they?
Well, indeed. I don't know what the selection process is like, and I don't know how they'll never run out of writers. God, how can they run out of what's published now? 90,000 books a day?
Yeah, but most of them aren't very good.
Well, but I mean, there's somebody who's writing them, and I don't think there'll be a want of literary lions.
Well, just because they write them doesn't make the book worth reading. How did you get the notification about this?
Someone called me on the telephone and said, if you're going to be in the neighborhood, drop in. You can be a literary lion, too, Greer.
Well, it's very timely. It happened to coincide with the publication of The Rabbi of Lud. How lucky for you.
Yes, it was. It was very nice.
Well, the last time we talked, it was the occasion of The Magic Kingdom, Stanley Elkins' The Magic Kingdom. And I guess that was about 2 years ago.
1985.
Yeah, 2 years ago. So tell me about some of the things that you've been doing and what's happened to you over the past 2 years.
Over the past 2 years, I've been writing The Rabbi of Lud. I'm now working on it. Excuse me.
Let me rephrase that last question. Other than working on The Rabbi of Lud, tell me about some of the things you've been doing over the past 2 years.
Well, I've been having heart bypass operations. That happened around about the time that The Rabbi of Lud came out, and I went in. But it was wonderful. I advise everybody to get one. It makes a new man out of me.
Oh, you had a heart condition sometime prior to that, didn't you?
Well, that's why I had the heart bypass operation. I remember the last time we were speaking, I kept popping nitroglycerin pills because I was in such pain. But when I went back to St. Louis, I put myself in the hospital, and then, boom, went to the strings of my heart. At any rate, I feel fine now.
So when was the operation?
In April of 1985.
Well, that was right after the Magic Kingdom, wasn't it?
That's right.
How long did it take to recover?
Not unusually long. I mean, I went to Breadloaf that summer, and that took place in August, so I must have been walking around and hopping and skipping like the other kids around the beginning of July, I suppose.
You're still teaching?
Indeed, I'm still teaching. I teach in the falls and off in the spring.
What kind of schedule do you have as a teacher?
Well, I teach two courses. I teach on a Tuesday and a Thursday. I don't have all that many students because this is a writing program. We don't admit all that many students.
How do you determine who's admitted to your workshop?
Well,
it is a workshop, isn't it?
It is a workshop, yes. And the kids submit stuff, and we've decided to play hardball and only accept the best students that we get. If we don't get any good submissions, we won't accept anybody.
This is on the graduate level?
Right. And so the candidates that we have, as a matter of fact, are fairly good.
What does someone, they don't get a degree in this, do they?
Or yes, they do. They get an MFA in, we started out giving an MFA in writing, and now they get an MA in writing. We changed the letters.
What do they do with a degree like that?
Well, they become teachers themselves, many of them, and some of them continue to write and publish, and they do what everybody else does with a degree.
Well, it seems to me that that would be a very worthwhile degree, or at least a form of study, to apply in almost anything, not necessarily teaching or writing. It seems to me that a writer has to be very self-disciplined and has to use words and use logic, and whether he becomes a creative writer or not, it would seem to me something like that would be extremely helpful.
We have a girl in the program now who intends, after she gets the degree, to go to medical school. I can't play Where Are They Now, because I don't really know where they are now. But most folks seem to get something out of the program. At least they learn how to read.
Well, the girl going to medical school, she could write more creative prescriptions. Be very helpful.
Or maybe cure somebody.
How's our friend Professor Gass?
He's doing just fine.
He was in town here the other day.
Yes, he was. He gave a speech at the National Book Awards ceremony. And I understand he did just grand.
I usually go to that. I missed it, but I had a good reason. I was celebrating my 20th year at CBS, and they threw us a 20, 30, 40-year banquet award, and I got a Tiffany watch, so I don't feel too guilty by not going.
What time is it?
I'm not wearing it. I'm wearing my old Seiko. But I wasn't familiar with this Heinemann. I can't even remember his first name.
Larry Heinemann.
That book just skipped by me, and I wasn't familiar with him at all.
Well, in 1980, I was the guest editor for the Best American Short Stories, which Shannon Ravenel puts out every year. And we printed one of Larry Heinemann's stories, something, as a matter of fact, from Paco's story, I think, The First Clean Fact. I'm not saying I discovered Larry Heinemann. I didn't. Larry Heinemann discovered Larry Heinemann.
Well, you can say you discovered Larry Heinemann.
Sure, okay, I discovered him. I made him what he is today.
I knew you could do it. See, you bring out the best in writers. Well, let's talk about your work a little bit. The Rabbi of Love, you were working on this manuscript at the time we talked last, and you told me that it was set actually in Lodi, New Jersey. I was going to ask you if there really indeed was a real place in New Jersey that was like Lud, and as I read the book, I said, no, there couldn't be. But there is?
What happened was that my mother and my aunt and many of my relatives have been buried in Lodi, New Jersey. And when, you know, you come to a place for a funeral, and particularly if you're a son, you have a kind of tunnel vision, and all you see is graveyard. And when Joan and I went to Lodi to bury my mother, the rabbi who came with the territory, I mean, was simply someone who worked for the funeral parlor, and had, since he didn't know my mother, had to ask us questions about the kind of lady she was, and we told him, you know, we were mourning and distraught ourselves, and so bad information, garbage in, garbage out. This guy gave a eulogy which was silly, and afterwards I began to think, since I usually begin my books with vocations as a starting point, vocation which is to become the metaphor for whatever it is I'm trying to say, I began to think about this rabbi. I don't remember what he looks like, and he's certainly not Jerry Goldcorn. But I began to think of the rabbi trade as a vocation that I could use in a novel. Hence, The Rabbi of Lod.
Well, it's a funny novel all the way through, and one of the more hilarious chapters takes place when the rabbi is sent to administer to the flock along the Alaskan pipeline. I didn't know there were any Alaskan pipeline Jewish workers up there.
Well, this was pure invention. I don't know that either.
Oh, that was very funny. All the Jewish references, the equipment that the rabbi uses that he took with him up to, or had shipped.
He didn't have it shipped.
No, it was shipped to him up in Alaska, right? And it was on the airplane with him when it went down, and all of that stuff. And there are all these other references with regard to holidays, religious holidays, and well, at any rate, of course, I'm not Jewish, and I'm not familiar with all of these terms and names and this sort of thing. But I just wonder how many Jews are familiar with all of these. It seems to me that even though you may be Jewish and grew up Jewish, you'd have to do an awful lot of research to drag all that stuff out.
Well, my research came through the telephone, and for the good fortune of having a well-stocked staff of rabbis working at the Hillel Foundation at Washington University. They're mentioned they're acknowledged in the book. And whenever I had a question, they were there to answer the question for me. Although a lot of times, a lot of that stuff is simply invented and does not exist in any tradition.
Oh, I thought I was learning something.
Well, you're only learning some things.
Now, this book, of course, The Rabbi of Blood, is different from The Magic Kingdom, which was the last book I read in many respects. But both deal a lot with death. And I think the last time we talked about death and we talked about dying and so forth. Is this an ongoing preoccupation with you?
You've just demonstrated two books in which it has been a preoccupation. But no, it's not something I think about all the time. But it seems to me that it's one of the biggies, isn't it? It's something that everybody has to come to terms with, and so why not have my characters do it for me? Although the book I'm working on now, a novel called The MacGuffin, doesn't have much to do with an obsession with death. Maybe an obsession with getting old, since I'm getting a little bit older.
Well, we all have that. That's certainly an obsession that seems to accelerate with each year, and especially when I reached 50, it began to intensify. In fact,
you don't look as if you've reached 50. That surprises me.
Well, I try to keep it disguised. I try to hide it. It's interesting. You mentioned the name of the book that you're working on now. In a moment ago, you said you usually start with a location, but it seems to me...
Vocation.
Seems that you also start with a name.
You mean I have a title for the book before I begin it? Not always.
Well, you haven't. Well, at least you have a title before you finished it.
Yes, indeed. Although, in the past, I wrote a collection of novellas and Searches and Seizures. And this was a title supplied to me by a friend of mine, Al Lebowitz. When I described it, he hadn't even read the book. I described some things about it, and he said, call it Searches and Seizures. He's a lawyer. I called it Searches and Seizures. It was very satisfactory.
Speaking of death, you were probably said...
We were speaking of Searches and Seizures.
That's already been published. But speaking of death, you probably were saddened about the death of Bill Whitehead, who I think he was your editor at Dutton, wasn't he?
He was my editor not only at Dutton, he was my editor at Macmillan. And when Macmillan absorbed Scribner's, he was my editor at Scribner's. He was the editor on this book, and he was a wonderful man. I dedicated the book to my wife, as I always do, but also to Bill Whitehead. Someone I was very fond of.
He did live long enough to see the completion of the book, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Although he was too ill, really, to work on it that closely, as closely as he usually did.
Yeah, that's very sad. I believe there was a service for him, and I think in Greenwich Village a little while ago.
Oh, I'm surprised to hear that. I thought I was coming to New York myself to participate in the memorial service sometime in December.
Well, maybe that's what it is. Maybe I saw it scheduled or was coming up, but I saw a reference to it somewhere, so you're probably right. Tell me about the way you approach this book and the way you approach most books. And the reason that's kind of a broad question, but the reason I'm asking it is that I sometimes see the writing of fiction kind of like a game, a word game, a puzzle. And you're putting it all together like a game.
Well, not like a game. I mean, the writing of any novel or of any short story or any poem poses problems. And one has to solve these problems with a kind of applied logic. But I don't regard it as a game. I regard it as a form of lower mathematics.
Well, I think a reader can. I'm not so sure about that. You're taking, you're creating something and you're putting it together, and you have to solve the problems that you have established at the very beginning. I was talking to a young writer a while back who writes a horror mystery. He's a young guy from England. And his parents hate his books, just despise them, and cannot stomach to read them, because he's got a lot of horrible stuff in there. And he couldn't understand why they didn't like it. And I suggested that maybe if he...
Maybe he's adopted.
Well, his parents preferred nonfiction anyway. But they also like to play games. They like to play Monopoly, and they work the crossword puzzles. And I just was thinking when he was telling me that if they were to look at his stories as though they're games, maybe they would have a better appreciation for them, because stories are games. They need to be solved, so there has to be a solution. And usually in a game, there is an ending that has to be solved.
Well, you're right, but I mean, you're saying game, I'm saying problem, and we're both saying solution.
The process of organizing your thoughts and creating these characters and putting them on paper. Tell me about that challenge for you.
Well, what's the idea? Once you have the basic idea, it seems to me that you then have to ask questions about, for example, in the book that I'm working on now, the man is a commissioner of streets. What kind of commissioners? What sort of things can happen to a commissioner of streets? What sort of things, you know, would he have to do? Well, I was watching the New York Marathon on television the other day, and it hadn't occurred to me, but a wonderful thing for a commissioner of streets to do, and I suppose a thing that a commissioner of streets actually does do, is just, you know, chart out where the marathon will be run, and what do you have to do to stop traffic where these runners, you know, occupy the space that cars would ordinarily occupy. So although I haven't worked it into the novel yet, I know that there is going to be part of the storyline is going to have to do with this marathon coming to town. And this would not occur to me if the fellow were not a commissioner of, I keep saying commissioner of streets, a street commissioner.
Or a traffic commissioner.
Well, he's a street commissioner.
Street commissioner in your book.
Right.
I think of traffic commissioner because I went to college with the ex-New York City traffic commissioner who is now in prison, unfortunately. Mr. Amoruso, he was actually 2 years behind me. But he's made a lot of money. Unfortunately, he can't spend it at the moment. One thing I can certainly say about you, you never repeat yourself, do you? I mean, every book seems to have different people, I mean, really different people in different locations, and just each one seems to come off the wall. You never, like Elmore Leonard, for example, is a wonderful writer, great dialogue, but everything seems alike, and including his titles. You know, I can't tell Glitz from Dutch and all these one word titles, you know, and the characters have different names, but they always seem the same. But that's not the way you do it, is it?
Well, I hope it's not the way I do it. And it seems to me that it's the obligation of a writer to at least to try not to repeat himself.
Well, if you want to sell more books, I think that's true. Made some notes on it. I want to be sure I covered everything here. Oh, I did want to ask you, after I did the piece on you 2 years ago, I got a call from the organization that, the Muscular Sclerosis Organization.
Multiple sclerosis.
I can't remember what they call it here, but they sent me a whole bunch of information about it, because I did a piece about how you have dealt with the disease and this sort of thing. But tell me a little bit about how you have fared with muscular sclerosis and
multiple
sclerosis.
I'm hanging in there, and I'm about the same as I was when I saw you 2 years ago. So I've sort of stabilized.
Well, I noticed you seem to be getting around pretty well, and I understood that this was a disease that is degenerative, that keeps on getting worse.
It is, but multiple sclerosis is a basket term, and no two people who suffer from the disease suffer in precisely the same way.
How it hasn't affected you to any greater degree in getting around the campus. You told me that you're now driving onto campus.
That's right. I'm still driving onto campus.
You're not using the... you're not using a... What do they call it?
An Amigo?
Jump rope. Is that what they call it?
A jump rope?
What do they call it? You know, the girls always used to jump rope. Don't you remember that?
I can't even dance. I don't know what you mean. I'm not using a jump rope. You mean I'm not skipping rope?
Skipping rope, is that what they call it in the Midwest, maybe? Well, one thing I can say is that certainly multiple sclerosis has not affected your mind, and it has not affected your ability to write, and in spite of your threat not to do any more writing after George Mills, thank God you didn't mean it. So we can expect a lot more good things for you. I appreciate the chance of being able to talk to you again, and congratulations not only on the Rabbi of Lod, but for becoming a literary lion.
Well, thank you very much.